Hello, welcome to another episode of Docent Pharma. Today we are joined by Jane Osman, who is a PhD candidate at Monash University, working at the ARC Centre for Fragment-Based Drug Design. A bit of background on his work, he's working with an emerging area of medicinal chemistry called PROTACs. Jane, welcome. Tell us a bit about yourself and what you're doing part of your PhD.
Hey, Luca. Thanks for having me. So I'm a PhD candidate here at Monash Institute of Pharmaceutical Science, and I'm supervised by Martin Scanlon and the rest of the guys at the Centre of Fragment-Based Drug Design and Monash Fragment Platform here. And we're funded by the Australian Research Council, and our focus here is, well, so my project is a pilot project for the Scanlon Group, and we haven't had any prior interest in PROTACs previously, but since it's an emerging field, it sparked interest. And so my project is about accelerating PROTAC discovery. And so currently PROTACs are, well, if you don't know what a PROTAC is, essentially it's a heterobifunctional molecule, which means that it's sort of like there's two binding parts to it. There's a protein of interest binder, and then you'll have an E3 ligase recruiter, and they're tethered by a chemical linker. And so essentially it's like two drugs that are linked together, and which would require like double the work to make. So my project is about making them in a more efficient way. And so typically a medicinal chemist would embark on, you know, chemical endeavors where they would synthesize hundreds of analogs to develop some SAR and get some structure-based drug design in there, whether it be through crystallography or NMR studies or whatever they're doing to interrogate those interactions. And then they'll guide their discovery that way. My project is about doing chemistry in a parallel way on the microscale in crude reaction mixtures. So essentially I have chemical handles on my protein of interest ligand and my E3 ligase recruiter, and I've designed a diverse linker library which covers pretty much all the relevant chemical space for linkers in the current PROTAC space based on a few databases. We designed an algorithm that picked those linkers for us, and we brought them in. And so I do reactions on the microscale, which is 2.5 micromolar in 96 well plates all at the same time, where I'll put in my starting material, the protein of interest binder with the carboxylic acid. My linker library has an amine and protected carboxylic acid on it, where I can do an amide coupling between those two and form the E3 ligase and linker conjugate. Then I can do a global deprotection across all the wells to deprotect the linker, and then couple on whatever E3 ligase binder I need on the end, whether it be cereblon or VHL E3 ligase recruiter, just as long as it's got a nucleophilic amine. And so in generating these PROTAC analogs in this parallel way, we can generate like a multitude of libraries of these PROTACs at once in crude. So it doesn't require any lengthy purification. And then what we do is we're currently in the process of developing the assay, which I got some promising results last week, actually. So that's kind of...
Love that.
Essentially, it's an assay that's capable of testing the affinity of the PROTACs for the ternary complex that they're forming with these two proteins, without purification. So essentially I can test all the PROTACs I make in the library at once via SPR, which is surface plasmon resonance, and give us an indication as to whether the PROTACs are going to work before we put them into cell degradation assays.
So that seems like a real good cost-effective way of streamlining the process. So a bit of background for our audience. So this field is within fragment-based drug design. Could you sort of explore the areas of fragment-based drug design and how it differs to maybe traditional methods like high-throughput screening?
Sure. So since my project is about PROTACs, they're not anywhere close to being as small as fragments, but we're trying to use fragment-like leads. And so a lot of other PhD students in the group making various chemical tools to interrogate the pharmacology of certain difficult targets like ECDSPA, FABP, HIV integrase, etc. But fragment-based drug design is a really cool method because what we do is, so a fragment is essentially like a 300 molecular weight or less compound, super small, which means like they're highly, they have a lot of potential for elaboration. I would say they're easier to buy than something that you'd find in a high throughput screen, which would typically be much larger and more drug-like. And so in a fragment-based drug design campaign, typically you would screen anywhere between 5,000 to, pretty much is limitless how big you can make your fragment libraries. But within the Scanlon group, we have a 3,000, I think it's 3,000 membered fragment-based fragment library. And the aim here is to perform a screen. So we make cocktails of these fragments where we include like five fragments in a cocktail, and we'll incubate them with the protein. And then we'll do numerous triple ligand detect NMR experiments to see some weak interactions. And although you'll find like a hit from fragment-based drug design will be much weaker than what you would get from a high throughput screen, the potential for elaboration is much more, since if you have like a fragment which binds to one site and then another fragment that binds to another site, then you can perform things like fragment linking, where you can gain affinity by linking two fragments that bind to two different sites in the molecule, rather than expecting something that's larger from a high throughput screen to fit that mold perfectly the first time. So I'd say there's more avenues to kind of like stray off the path, and that way you can keep in mind things like physicochemical properties that obviously you want to keep a close eye on, so because you want things to be soluble. And I just think it's a very cool method to start a drug campaign.
Yeah, lots of different ways for early stage drug discovery. So with PROTACs, it's interesting how they tackle a different mechanism of action, so the protein ubiquitination. But I wanted to dive into, what are the main reasons PROTACs are getting the interest at the moment? Like, what's so special about them, and what key challenges are involved in developing them?
Oh, yeah, cool. So PROTACs are really cool because they can effectively induce protein knockout. So we can do this with silencing RNAs and things like that. But the thing is, silencing RNA has probably less potential to become a therapeutic, even though there are formulations that they're working towards for those type of things. But a PROTAC is still regarded as a small molecule, even though it's outside the beyond rule of five chemical space. And the reason they're cool is because, as opposed to traditional inhibition, which is what medicinal chemists have been trying to achieve for the past like 100 years of medicinal chemistry, PROTACs are a way that we can induce degradation of proteins rather than just inhibiting them. So typically you would have an inhibitor drug that binds to the protein, falls off, gets excreted, and then you need to take another tablet. And this is it's an occupancy-driven mode of action, whereas a PROTAC is event-driven. And so they act substoichiometrically, which means that one PROTAC molecule has the potential to degrade multiple units of protein of interest, since they bind to the E3 ligase and the protein of interest, allowing that ubiquitination that you mentioned earlier. And then once that protein has been ubiquitinated, the PROTAC can then fall off and then go to catalyze the ubiquitination of another unit. Whereas if you had a traditional inhibitor drug, you would usually expect the stoichiometry to be one-to-one. Like, you would need to have enough drug to occupy all the protein there, so there'll be one drug molecule per protein. But in a PROTAC's case, it's like one PROTAC molecule to many proteins.
So based off that, we can sort of expect lower doses of these drugs because you're using one PROTAC to act on many different proteins. So yeah. I think that's good for the drug discovery side, but also further down the drug discovery pipeline, where it's going to go to patients and they'll be taking a lower dose.
Yeah, 100%. You really don't need much PROTAC to get good ternary complex. Well, to detect ternary complex, let alone get degradation. I think like exemplary PROTACs really need like pico and nanomolar concentrations to get that degradation.
So forming a good ternary complex, I expect it would involve optimizing the linker between the two binders. So what are the hurdles of a linker that is too long compared to maybe a linker that is too short? Like, what needs to be considered during this development stage?
Yeah, so this is actually a really important point that you've just brought up. I would say the linker is probably the most important part to the PROTAC. And it's essentially like, to answer your question, too long would essentially mean that the two proteins are too far away to get that ubiquitin transfer, and too close induces steric clashing between the two proteins, and they won't want to orientate together. So you want so first off, a lot of PROTAC campaigns start with interrogating that length of linker to begin with. And so usually you'll employ things like polyethylene glycol or alkyl chains, and they're very easy to get, synthetically accessible things to use. And you can get varying lengths. So you can firstly start to probe what length of linker your two proteins prefer, to understand like how close they can get to each other. But recently, like, there's been a lot of PROTACs coming out where they're introducing things like stereocenters into the linker in order to create more conformationally restricted ternary complexes, and also things like macrocyclic PROTACs, which also achieve the same thing. Essentially, it's reducing the amount of freedom for that ternary complex to form as compared to something like a PEG or alkyl chain. So usually you would use something that's synthetically accessible like that to first probe what distance you're working with, and then you can then start to see what structures of linker are going to benefit you. And then further down the track, you might want to make changes to the linker that might influence the physicochemical properties like bioavailability, since they are beyond rule of five class of compounds.
Mm-hmm.
And like the work that I think it was Bristol Myers Squibb did recently on SMARCA 2 and 4, or was it KRAS? I can't exactly remember. I probably should have my literature down pat. But essentially, they discovered a PROTAC that is capable of folding on over each other. And mm-hmm. So it reduces that exposed polar surface area, which helps PROTAC stay very compact when it's being absorbed. And then when it's time to form the ternary complex, it unfolds and brings those two together. So it's very smart things, like very clever signs like this that just keep blowing open the doors for PROTAC discovery and targeted protein degradation in general.
Yeah, because it seems like your research area of PROTACs is quite unique. It's focusing on, like you said, the acceleration of PROTAC development. So what are the main drivers part of your project that's actually contributing towards this acceleration? Like, what's a big highlight that you think that's forming this part?
Yeah, cool. So the two main points that I'm trying to exemplify, get across, is that one, crude reaction screening is the first thing. So without need for purification, which is the obvious time killer for chemists, because, you know, if you have racemic mixtures and things like that, or enantiomers, or, you know, just isomers in general, or things that like to rearrange, it's like the difference in polarity between those things sometimes are very little and difficult to separate without things like prep HPLC and things like that, which would be quite difficult to do with normal column chromatography in the lab. So yeah, things like that slow down medicinal chemists a lot. So if you can perform these reactions where you're simply just adding more reagent, adding more starting material, adding linker, adding E3 ligase, you can essentially do it a whole PROTAC scheme in a day or two, compared to someone who's just trying to make one PROTAC and purify all the intermediates. It might take them a week to get that single PROTAC, and doing it in the parallel format means that you can do all this chemistry in one time. So essentially, with the linker library we've got, it's 43 members at the moment, could get bigger. I can perform 43 reactions and make 43 analogs at the same time, which is, in that acceleration, well, a part of that acceleration paradigm. In terms of the crude reaction screening, without purification, like putting it onto the SPR, it's really cool that we can see ternary complex formation on SPR, all because of the assay that Michael Roy established with Alessio Ciulli's lab in that seminal paper, which we're basing this project off. But essentially, being able to screen the PROTACs as crude mixtures is a major move forward. And like, it's already been done by AstraZeneca in a recent paper where they're doing crude reaction screening with one step, and that is huge. Like director biology approaches, I forgot which group are exactly doing that, but they're doing amazing work. I think they're from China. They recently applied that to molecular glues as well as PROTACs, where they're doing amide couplings in DMSO, just diluting it and chucking it straight into cells for degradation assays. It's like, since PROTACs are so complex, it's like, the chemistry efforts is really like a bottleneck for them. And so, that's why it's prompting all these groups around the world, including our group, to try and accelerate the process. And so they're the two drivers, I'd say.
It looks at, so SPR, I think it's surface plasmon resonance, am I correct?
Yeah,
that looks to be like a state-of-the-art technology that your group is using at the moment. So how rewarding is it using analytical methods that are at the forefront of drug development. What kind of things did you not know about before SPR?
Oh, SPR is really cool. Like, it's cool because you can see the kinetics of your PROTAC, and pretty much you can see kinetics of pretty much anything on SPR. So the way it works is essentially they have a chip where they immobilize the protein or whatever you want to keep constant in your system. And then you can inject whatever analyte you'd like to flow over the top. And through this chip, we shine this light, and the refractive index of the light changes from, and it obviously is detected. And that change in refractive index is what gives you real time readout of the changes that are occurring on the surface of the chip. And so for me, like working with the likes of Menachem Gunzberg, he's a great scientist in the Scanlon lab. He's been really good to try and teach me how to get this technique down pat. I'm still don't have my head around the complete experimental design, but the sheer range of like concentrations we can run and the analytical prowess of SPR is still like pretty much, well, it's being tapped, but yeah, there's still so much potential there, and we're trying to push it with this crude reaction screening. The only thing we need to be careful of is that we don't actually like clog the SPR filter, because that can cost like $10,000.
Expensive.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, yeah, there's been a few runs that haven't been successful, and like I've been reminded that, you know, a run on the SPR does cost like $5,000 a day or something like that. So yeah, it's kind of a lot of pressure, I'm not gonna lie. I feel bad for the ones that I have stuffed up, but the ones that have worked have been really good and driven the project forward. So I'd say it's a really powerful technique, and I've only had 5 days on the SPR myself in total throughout my whole PhD, but in those days I've gotten so much data readout, like, yeah, it's crazy. Really been helpful.
That's awesome. So yeah, PROTACs, it seems that your group's project is focusing on the potential of PROTACs to be an emerging drug class. Do you know about any other applications that PROTACs would have in the wider scheme of things?
Yeah, so obviously they're being looked at as therapeutic potential, but one of the interests within my group, I've got a couple of protein targets, and my second protein target is looking at the fatty acid binding proteins, which are a chaperone for fatty acids within the cell. But pretty much because there's 9 isoforms of these fatty acid binding proteins, their pharmacology is quite like mysterious. And so Martin's been interested in fatty acid binding protein 4 for quite a while. And that's what I've been assigned with, using one of the hits that one of our PhD students is working on. One of my colleagues, I should say. But yeah, we're trying to use PROTACs as a chemical tool. So we're trying to induce knockout, not just to achieve a therapeutic, but also to investigate the pharmacology of FABP4. And obviously we could perform knockout assays, but if you have a chemical tool that you can possibly develop a therapeutic for, then it's kind of like provides that ground in between where, yeah, you can see the pharmacology effects of a knockout, and you also have something developable now that you can turn into a degrader. So honestly, like, I don't know the full potential of PROTACs. People are calling it a renaissance in the medicinal chemistry field as we speak. So yeah, there's just too much coming out at the moment to really keep up with. But so far I've seen them used as, so not just degrading proteins, like, you know, PROTACs done for proteolysis targeting chimeras, they degrade proteins. We got LITACs, which degrades lysosomes. We've got RIPTACs hitting RNAs and I think it's ribosome. I'm pretty sure it's RNA though. It's like pretty much any target that you have a binder for, you can turn into something that you can ubiquitinate with this bifunctional format. So definitely, yeah, it does extend past the realm of protein degradation. It can lead into pretty much the degradation of anything we can bind to. And we'll accept the ubiquitin unit, of course.
So yeah, it's really good that we're exploring ways, the emerging areas of medicinal chemistry, and it's really good that students are able to learn about these fields. However, I feel that a lot of students may need some work about presenting their scientific findings. So I know that you've got experience of presenting your research before. So what advice would you give to students who are presenting their research for the first time, or presenting an early stage university project that they need to share technical knowledge for?
Oh yeah. So look, honestly, presenting, like, I don't think I'm good at it, and I always say that I'm bad at it because I think I am. But then when people hear me present, they go, oh yeah, you can present. I'm like, I don't know what you guys see. Like, what's and like, it sounds cocky, but like at the same time, I think it's about like It's about not being too confident in what you're saying, but and in that way, finding comfort in rather than trying to present your data, it's more about talking to the audience and just kind of like explaining what you're doing. Like, because you could be doing something amazing and you know you've done really good research, and but trying to frame it in such a like big way might just go against you. If you can just frame it in the most simple way possible, in the most layman term that you can possibly get, obviously depending on your audience, then you'll be an effective presenter, because it's about how accessible your knowledge is. It's not actually about it is about the knowledge itself, but the more accessible your knowledge is obviously what's going to drive the audience's appreciation for your talk. So whenever I go into talking, like, obviously I get super nervous. Another thing that I found is really funny is like I like a bit TMI, but I do sweat a lot because I get so nervous before presenting. But if you just make a joke of it to yourself, sometimes like sometimes I say to myself, oh shit, like I can feel myself starting to sweat. I'm like, oh, you know what? Instead of just sweating a drop this time, I'm going to sweat bucket loads. And then all of a sudden I'll stop sweating. It's like this paradox within myself. It's like, and it applies to everyone. Like it's well documented. Psychiatrist Viktor Frankl talked about it. But it's some type of paradoxical therapy where you can just like make a joke of your own insecurities to yourself to the point that it becomes ridiculous and actually eases the anxious symptoms. So if you just think to yourself like, oh yeah, maybe I'm going to sound stupid, then you say, you know what, I'm going to sound as stupid as I can. And then you just say things as simple as you possibly can, then you know what, you'll be a great presenter, because simple is easy to understand.
A lot of students now, where the university is encouraging presenting your work, part of the master's program. We're doing scoping presentations, part of our industry placement that we'll be doing. So it's really good to get this insight on like how we can sort of better these techniques to become a good presenter and talk confidently, but also comfortably in the knowledge that we're presenting.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I think like I've seen a few presentations myself from some students, and I think the worst thing you can possibly do is try to sound scientific. Like, don't try and use words you don't fully understand. Just stick to simple basic terminology, because that's what's going to get the audience involved.
Because usually you've only got maybe 5 to 10 minutes, so you don't want something to go over someone's head. You want to explain it clearly, concisely, and get your message across the board.
Yeah, and awesome. People have the attitude that, you know, questions are a bad thing, but questions are great. So if you explain something simple, then you leave room for people to ask questions, and that's where you get the best engagement.
So what kind of advice do you have when it comes to question time? Like, are you ever put on the spot? How do you sort of handle that? Because part of presenting a good presentation is being able to answer the questions effectively that the audience give. So how does that sort of scope out for you?
Yeah, so the first thing I'm going to say is don't be afraid to say you don't know something. It's very easy to talk like a crap, I'd say. Like, you can just start talking about whatever they're saying and it won't make
where it's going.
Yeah, like it's much easier just to say like you don't know. If you truly don't know something, straight up just say you don't know it. Be like, I'll be happy to look into that. Even, you know, give them your email afterwards and be like, yeah, shoot me that question and whatever literature is surrounding that, I'll look into it. You know, just obviously take a deep breath. Remember, it's your work at the end of the day. You only talk about what you know. And that's as far as you can take it, you know. If you're up to date with literature, obviously you can reference literature and things like that. But otherwise, my main advice is like, if you don't know something, just don't say it. If you do know something, obviously provide detail, but just don't provide too much detail in the presentation that it sidetracks the story of your talk. So that way you can give yourself those times, that time to talk about it in the questions, like I said earlier.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jan. Thanks for your time today to get an insight of your research area, about PROTEX and medicinal chemistry in general, but also about student presentations and how they can start bettering them. Thank you so much for being a part of Dose of Pharma. And yeah, thanks for tuning in, and I'll hope to see you next time.
Dose of Pharma acknowledges the traditional custodians of the various lands throughout Australia on which we connect today, and pays respect to elders past, present, and future.